CD5.
Drake shut the door to his office. "I need your counsel, Peter," he said quietly. He walked around to his desk, picked up some papers, and slid them toward Evans. "What the fuck is this?" Evans looked. "That is George's withdrawal of support."
"Did you draw it up?"
"I did."
"Whose idea was paragraph 3A?
"Paragraph 3A?
"Yes. Did you add that little bit of wisdom?"
"I don't really remember."
"Then let me refresh your memory,"
Drake said. He picked up the document and started to read.
"In the event of any claim that I am not of sound mind, there may be an attempt to obtain injunctive relief from the terms of this document. Therefore, this document authorizes the payment of $50,000 per week to NERF while awaiting the judgment of a full trial. Said money shall be deemed sufficient to pay ongoing costs incurred by NERF and shall, by said payment, deny injunctive relief." "Did you write this, Evans?"
"I did."
"Whose idea was it?"
"George's."
"George is not a lawyer. He had help."
"Not from me," Evans said. "He more or less dictated that clause. I wouldn't have thought of it." Drake snorted in disgust.
$50,000 a week," he said. "At that rate, it will take us 4 years to receive the $10 million grant."
"That's what George wanted the document to say," Evans said.
"But whose idea was it?" Drake said. "If it wasn't you, who was it?"
"I don't know."
"Find out!"
"I don't know if I can," Evans said. "I mean, George is dead now, and I don't know who he might have consulted." Drake glared at Evans.
"Are you with us here, Peter, or not?" He started pacing back and forth. "Because this Vanuatu litigation is undoubtedly the most significant lawsuit we have ever filed."
He lapsed into his speech-making mode.
"The stakes are enormous, Peter. Global warming is the greatest crisis facing mankind. You know that. I know that. Most of the civilized world knows that. We must act to save the planet before it is too late."
"Yes," Evans said, "I know that."
"Do you?"
Drake said.
"We have a lawsuit, a very important lawsuit that needs our help. And $50,000 a week will strangle it."
Evans was sure that was not true. $50,000 is a lot of money," he said. "I don't see why it should strangle."
"Because it will!"
Drake snapped.
"Because I am telling you it will!"
He seemed surprised by his own outburst. He gripped the desk, got control of himself.
"Look," he said, "we can never forget about our opponents here. The forces of industry are strong, phenomenally strong. An industry wants to be left alone to pollute. It wants to pollute here and in Mexico and in China and wherever else it does its business. The stakes are huge."
"I understand," Evans said.
"Many powerful forces are taking an interest in this case, Peter."
"Yes, I'm sure."
"Forces that will stop at nothing to be sure that we lose it."
Evans frowned. What was Drake telling him?
"Their influence is everywhere, Peter. They may have influence with members of your law firm, or other people you know. People whom you believe you can trust, but you can't. Because they are on the other side, and they don't even know it."
Evans said nothing. He was just looking at Drake.
"Be prudent, Peter. Watch your back. Don't discuss what you are doing with anyone, except me. Try not to use your cell phone. Avoid email. And keep an eye out in case you are followed."
"Okay. But actually, I've already been followed," Evans said.
"There's a Blue Prius. Those were our guys. I don't know what they are doing. I called them off days ago."
"Your guys?"
"Yes. It's a new security firm we've been trying out. They're obviously not very competent."
"I'm confused," Evans said. "NERF has a security firm?"
"Absolutely. for years now, because of the danger we face. Please understand me. We are all in danger, Peter. Don't you understand what this lawsuit means if we win? Trillions of dollars that industry must pay in the coming years to halt their emissions that are causing global warming. Trillions! With those stakes, a few lives don't matter. So be very damn careful.
Evans said that he would. Drake shook his hand.
I want to know who told George about the paragraph, Drake said. And I want that money freed up for us to use it as we see fit. This is all riding on you now, he said. Good luck, Peter.
On his way out of the building, Evans ran into a young man who was sprinting up the stairs. They collided so hard that Evans was almost knocked down. The young man apologized hastily and continued on his way. He looked like one of the kids working on the conference. Evans wondered what the crisis could be. Now. When he got back outside, he looked down the street. The blue Prius was gone. He got into the car and drove back to Morton's to see Sarah.
Holmby Hills, Tuesday, October 5th, 5:57 p.m. Traffic was heavy. He crept slowly along Sunset. He had plenty of time to think. The conversation with Drake left him feeling odd. There had been a funny quality to the actual meeting, as if it didn't really need to happen. As if Drake just wanted to make sure he was able to call Evans in and Evans would come, as if he were asserting his authority or something like that. Anyway, Evans felt something was off. And Evans also felt a little strange about the security firm. That just didn't seem right. After all, Nerf was one of the good guys. They shouldn't be sneaking around and following people. And Drake's paranoid warnings were somehow not persuasive. Drake was overreacting, as he so often did. Drake was dramatic by nature. He couldn't help it. Everything was a crisis. Everything was desperate. Everything was vitally important. He lived in a world of extreme urgency, but it wasn't necessarily the real world. Evans called his office, but Heather had gone for the day. He called Lowenstein's office and spoke to Lisa. Listen, he said, I need your help. Her voice was lower, conspiratorial.
Of course, Peter.
My apartment was robbed.
No. You too?
Yes, me too. And I really need to talk to the police.
Well, yes, you certainly do. My goodness.
Did they take anything? I don't think so, he said. But just to file a report, all that. I'm kind of busy right now dealing with Sarah. It may go later into the night.
Well, of course. Do you need me to deal with the police about your robbery?
Could you? He said. It would help so much.
Why, of course, Peter, she said. Leave it to me.
She paused. When she spoke again, it was almost a whisper.
Is there anything you don't want the police to find?
No, he said.
I mean, it's all right with me. Everybody in L.A. has a few bad habits. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here.
No, Lisa, he said. Actually, I don't have any drugs, if that's what you mean.
Oh, no, she said quickly. I wasn't assuming anything.
No pictures or anything like that?
No, Lisa.
Nothing, you know, underage?
Afraid not.
Okay. I just wanted to be sure.
Well, thanks for doing this. Now, to get in through the door,
I know, she said. The key is under the back mat.
Yes.
He paused. How'd you know that?
Peter, she said, sounding a little offended. You can count on me to know things.
All right.
Well, thanks.
Don't mention it. Now, what about Margot? How's she doing? Lisa said.
She's fine.
You went to see her?
This morning, yes, and
no, I mean at the hospital.
Didn't you hear? Margot was coming back from the bank today and walked in while her apartment was being robbed. Three robberies in one day. You, Margot, Sarah? What is going on? Do you know?
No, Evans said. It's very mysterious.
It is.
But about Margot.
Oh, yes. So I guess she decided to fight these guys,
which was the wrong thing to do, and they beat her up, maybe knocked her unconscious.
She had a black eye, I heard, and while the cops were there interviewing her, she passed out, got completely paralyzed and couldn't move, and she even stopped breathing.
You're kidding.
No.
I had a long conversation with the detective who was there.
He told me it just came over her, and she was unable to move, and was dark blue before the paramedics showed up and took her to UCLA. She's been in intensive care all afternoon.
The doctors are waiting to ask her about the blue ring.
What blue ring? Just before she became paralyzed, she was slurring her words, but she said something about the blue ring, or the blue ring of death.
The blue ring of death, Evans said. What does that mean?
They don't know. She isn't able to talk yet. Does she take drugs?
No. She's a health nut, Evans said.
Well, I hear the doctor say she'll be okay. It was some temporary paralysis.
I'll go see her later, he said.
When you do, will you call me afterward? And I'll handle your apartment. Don't worry.
It was dark when he got to Morton's house. The security people were gone. The only car parked in front was Sarah's Porsche. She opened the front door when he rang. She had changed into a tracksuit. Everything all right? He said.
Yes, she said.
They came into the hallway and they crossed to the living room. The lights were on, and the room was warm and inviting. Where are the security people?
They left for dinner. They'll be back.
They all left?
They'll be back. I want to show you something, she said.
She pulled out a wand with an electronic meter attached to it. She ran it over his body, like an airport security check. She tapped his left pocket.
Empty it.
The only thing in his pocket were his car keys. He dropped them on the coffee table. Sarah was running the wand over his chest, his jacket. She touched his right jacket pocket, gestured for him to empty it out. What's this about? He said. She shook her head and didn't speak. He pulled out a penny, set it on the counter. She waved her hand. More? He felt again. Nothing. She ran the wand over his car keys. There was a plastic rectangle on the chain, which unlocked his car door. She pried it open with a pocket knife. Hey, listen. The rectangle popped open. Evans saw electronic circuits inside, a watch battery. Sarah pulled out a tiny bit of electronics, hardly bigger than the tip of a lead pencil. Bingo. Is that what I think it is? She took the electronic unit and dropped it into a glass of water. Then she turned to the penny. She examined it minutely, then twisted it in her fingers. To Evans's surprise, it broke in half, revealing a small electronic center. She dropped that in the glass of water, too.
Where's your car? She said.
Out in front.
We can check it later.
He said,
what's this about? The security guys found bugs on me, she said, and all over the house.
The best guess is that was the reason for the robbery, to plant bugs.
And guess what? You have bugs, too.
He looked around. Is the house okay?
The house has been electronically swept and cleared. The guys found about a dozen bugs.
Supposedly, it's clean now. They sat together on the couch.
Whoever is doing all this, they think we know something, she said, and I'm beginning to believe they're right.
Evans told her about Morton's comments about the list.
He bought a list? She said.
Evans nodded. That's what he said.
Did he say what kind of list?
No.
He was going to tell me more, but he never got around to it. He didn't say anything more to you when you were alone with him?
Not that I remember. Going up on the plane? No. At the table at dinner? I don't think so, no. When you walked him to his car? No, he was singing all that time. It was sort of embarrassing, to tell you the truth. And then he got in his car. Wait a minute. Evan sat up. He did say one funny thing. What was that? It was some Buddhist philosophical saying. He told me to remember it. What was it? I don't remember, Evan said. At least, not exactly. It was something like, everything that matters is near where the Buddha sits. George wasn't interested in Buddhism, Sarah said. Why would he say that to you? Everything that matters is near where the Buddha sits, Evan said, repeating it again. He was staring forward into the media room adjacent to the living room. Sarah, directly facing them, under dramatic overhead lighting, was a large wooden sculpture of a seated Buddha, Burmese, 14th century. Evans got up and walked into the media room. Sarah followed him. The sculpture was 4 feet high and mounted on a high pedestal. Evans walked around behind the statue. You think? Sarah said. Maybe. He ran his fingers around the base of the statue. There was a narrow space there, beneath the crossed legs. But he could feel nothing. He crouched, looked. Nothing. There were some wide cracks in the wood of the statue, but nothing was there. Maybe move the base, Evan said. It's on rollers, Sarah said. They slid it to one side, exposing nothing but white carpet. Evan sighed. Any other Buddhas around here? He said, looking around the room. Sarah was down on her hands and knees. Peter, she said. What? Look. He crouched down. There was a roughly 1-inch gap between the base of the pedestal and the floor. Barely visible in that gap was the corner of an envelope, attached to the inside of the pedestal. I'll be damned. It's an envelope. She slid her fingers in. Can you reach it?
I think so.
Got it! She pulled it out. It was a business-size envelope, sealed and unmarked.
This could be it, she said, excited. Peter, I think we may have found it.
The lights went out, and the house was plunged into darkness. They scrambled to their feet. What happened? Evans said.
It's okay, she said. The emergency generator will cut in at any second.
Actually, it won't, a voice in the darkness said.
Two powerful flashlights shone directly in their faces. Evans squinted in the harsh light. Sarah raised her hand to cover her eyes.
May I have the envelope, please? The voice said.
Sarah said, no. There was a mechanical click, like the cocking of a gun.
We'll take the envelope, the voice said, one way or another.
No, you won't, Sarah said. Standing beside her, Evans whispered,
Sarah!
Shut up, Peter. They can't have it.
We'll shoot if we have to, the voice said.
Sarah, give them the fucking envelope, Evans said. Let them take it, Sarah said defiantly.
Sarah!
Bitch!
The voice screamed, and a gunshot sounded. Evans was embroiled in chaos and blackness. There was another scream. One of the flashlights bounced on the floor and rolled, pointing in a corner. In the shadows, Evans saw a large, dark figure attack Sarah, who screamed and kicked. Without thinking, Evans threw himself against the attacker, grabbing an arm and a leather jacket. He could smell the man's beery breath, hear him grunting. Then someone else pulled him off, slamming him to the ground, and he was kicked in the ribs. He rolled away, banging against the furniture, and then a new deep voice held up a flashlight and said, "Move away now!" Immediately, the attacker stopped fighting with them and turned to this new voice. Evans looked back to see Sarah, who was on the floor. Another man got up and turned toward the flashlight. There was a crackling sound, and the man screamed and fell backward. The flashlight swung to the man who had been kicking Peter. "You, down!" The man immediately lay on the carpet. "Face down!" The man rolled over. "That's better," the new voice said. "Are you two all right?"
"I'm fine," Sarah said, panting, staring into the light. "Who the hell are you?"
"Sarah," the voice said. "I'm disappointed you don't recognize me." Just then the lights came back up in the room. Sarah said,
"John!"
And to Evans's astonishment, she stepped across the body of the fallen attacker to give a grateful hug to John Kenner, professor of geo-environmental engineering at MIT. Holmby Hills, Tuesday, October 5th, 8:03 p.m.
"I think I deserve an explanation," Evans said.
Kenner had crouched down and was handcuffing the two men lying on the floor. The first man was still unconscious.
"It's a modulated taser," Kenner said. "Shoots a 500 megahertz dart that delivers a 4-millisecond jolt that inactivates cerebellar functioning. Down you go. Unconsciousness is immediate, but it only lasts a few minutes."
"No," Evans said. "I meant..."
"Why am I here?" Kenner said,
looking up with a faint smile.
"Yes. He's a good friend of George's," Sarah said.
"He is?" Evans said. "Since when?"
"Since we all met a while back," Kenner said. "And I believe you remember my associate, Sanyang Tapa, as well."
A compact, muscular young man with dark skin and a crew cut came into the room. As before, Evans was struck by his vaguely military bearing and his British accent.
"Lights are all back on, Professor," Sanyang Tapa said. "Should I call the police?"
"Not just yet," Kenner said. "Give me a hand here, Sanyang."
Together, Kenner and his friend went through the pockets of the handcuffed men.
"As I thought," Kenner said, straightening at last. "No identification on them."
"Who are they?"
"That'll be a question for the police," he said. The men were beginning to cough and wake up. "Sanyang, let's get them to the front door."
They hauled the intruders to their feet and half-led, half-dragged them out of the room. Evans was alone with Sarah.
"How did Kenner get in the house?" "He was in the basement. He's been searching the house most of the afternoon."
"And why didn't you tell me?"
"I asked her not to," Kenner said, walking back into the room. "I wasn't sure about you. This is a complicated business."
He rubbed his hands together.
"Now then, shall we have a look at that envelope?"
"Yes."
Sarah sat down on the couch and tore it open. A single sheet of paper, neatly folded, was inside. She stared at it in disbelief. Her face fell.
"What is it?" Evans said.
Without a word, she handed it to him. It was a bill from the Edwards Fine Art Display Company of Torrance, California, for construction of a wooden pedestal to support a statue of a Buddha, dated 3 years ago. Feeling dejected, Evan sat down on the couch next to Sarah.
"What?" Kenner said. "Giving up already?"
"I don't know what else to do."
"You can begin by telling me exactly what George Morton said to you."
"I don't remember exactly."
"Tell me what you do remember."
"He said it was a philosophical saying, and it was something like, everything that matters is near where the Buddha sits."
"No, that's impossible," Kenner said, in a definite tone.
"Why?"
"He wouldn't have said that."
"Why?"
Kenner sighed. "I should think it's self-evident. If he was giving instructions, which we presume he was, he wouldn't be so inexact. So he must have said something else."
"That's all I remember," Evans said, defensively. Evans found Kenner's quick matter to be brusque, almost insulting. He was beginning not to like this man.
"That's all you remember," Kenner said. "Let's try again. Where did George make this statement to you? It must have been after you left the lobby."
At first, Evans was puzzled. Then he remembered.
"Were you there?" "Yes, I was. I was in the parking lot off to one side."
Why? Evans said. We'll discuss that later, Kenner said. You were telling me you and George went outside.
Yes, Evans said. We went outside. It was cold, and George stopped singing when he felt the cold. We were standing on the steps of the hotel waiting for the car.
Uh-huh.
And when it came, he got into the Ferrari, and I was worried he shouldn't be driving. And I asked him about that, and George said, this reminds me of a philosophical saying, and I said, what is it? And he said, everything that matters is not far from where the Buddha sits.
Not far, Kenner said.
That's what he said.
All right, Kenner said. And at this moment you were...
Leaning over the car.
The Ferrari.
Yes.
Leaning over. And when George told you this philosophical saying, what did you answer back?
I just asked him not to drive.
Did you repeat the phrase?
No,
Evans said. Why not?
Because I was worried about him. He shouldn't be driving. Anyway, I remember thinking it was sort of awkwardly phrased, not remote from where the Buddha sits.
Not remote?
Kenner said.
Yes,
Evans said.
He said to you, not remote.
Yes.
Much better, Kenner said.
He was moving restlessly around the room, his eyes flicking from object to object, touching things, dropping them, moving on.
Why is it much better?
Evans said irritably. Kenner gestured around the room.
Look around you, Peter. What do you see?
I see a media room.
Exactly.
Well, I don't understand.
Sit down on the couch, Peter.
Evans sat down, still furious. He crossed his arms over his chest and glowered at Kenner. The doorbell rang. They were interrupted by the arrival of the police.
Kenner said, let me handle this. It's easier if they don't see you.
And he again walked out of the room. From the hallway, they heard several low voices discussing the two captured intruders. It sounded all very chummy. Evans said, does Kenner have something to do with law enforcement?
Not exactly.
What does that mean?
He just seems to know people.
Evans stared at her. He knows people, he repeated.
Different sorts of people, yes.
He sent George off to see a lot of them. Kenner has a tremendously wide range of contacts, particularly in the environmental area. Is that what the Center for Risk Analysis does? Environmental risks?
I'm not sure. Why is he on sabbatical? You should ask him these things.
Okay.
You don't like him, do you?
She said. I like him fine. I just think he's a conceited asshole.
He's very sure of himself,
she said. Assholes usually are. Evans got up and walked to where he could see into the hallway. Kenner was talking to the policeman, signing some documents, and turning over the intruders. The police were joking with him. Standing to one side was the dark man, Sanyong.
And what about the little guy with him? Sanyong Tapa, she said.
Kenner met him in Nepal when he was climbing a mountain there. Sanyong was a Nepali military officer assigned to help a team of scientists studying soil erosion in the Himalaya. Kenner invited him back to the States to work with him.
I remember now. Kenner is a mountain climber, too. And he was almost on the Olympic ski team.
Evans couldn't conceal his annoyance.
Sarah said, he's a remarkable man, Peter, even if you don't like him.
Evans returned to the couch, sat down again, folded his arms. Well, you're right about that, he said. I don't.
I have the feeling you're not alone there, she said.
The list of people who dislike John Kenner is a long one. Evans snorted and said nothing. They were still sitting on the couch when Kenner came bounding back into the room. He was again rubbing his hands.
All right, he said. All the two boys have to say is that they want to talk to a lawyer. And they seem to know one, imagine that. But we'll know more in a few hours.
He turned to Peter.
So, mystery solved? Concerning the Buddha?
Evans glared at him. No.
Really?
It's quite straightforward.
Why don't you just tell us?
Evans said.
Reach your right hand out to the end table, Kenner said.
Evans put his hand out. There were 5 remote controls on the table.
Yes, he said. And?
What are they for?
It's a media room, Evans said. I think we've established that.
Yes, Kenner said. But what are they for?
Obviously, Evans said. To control the television, the satellite, the DVD, the VHS, all that.
Which one does which? Kenner said.
Evans stared at the table, and suddenly he got it.
Oh, my God, he said. You're absolutely right.
He was flipping them over one after another. This one's the flat panel, DVD, satellite, high def... He stopped. There was one more.
Looks like there are 2 DVD controllers.
The second one was stubby and black and had all the usual buttons, but it was slightly lighter than the other. Evans pulled open the battery compartment. Only 1 battery was there. In place of the other was a tightly rolled piece of paper.
Bingo, he said.
He took the paper out. All that matters is not remote from where the Buddha sits. That's what George had said, which meant that this paper was all that matters. Carefully, Evans unrolled the tiny sheet and pressed it flat on the coffee table with the heel of his hand, smoothing out the wrinkles. And then he stared. The paper contained nothing but columns of numbers and words. The words were terror, snake, laughter, scorpion, alt, terror, sever, conch, scorpion, alt, terror, buzzard, old man, scorpion, alt, terror, black mesa, snarl, scorpion. Evans said, Is this what everybody's after?
Sarah was looking at the paper over his shoulder.
I don't get it. What does it mean?
Evans passed the paper to Kenner. He hardly glanced at it before he said,
No wonder they were so desperate to get this back.
You know what it is?
There's no doubt about what it is,
Kenner said, handing the paper to Sanyong.
It's a list of geographic locations.
Locations? Where?
We'll have to calculate that, Sanyong said. They're recorded in UTM, which may mean the listing was intended for pilots.
Kenner saw the blank looks on the others' faces.
The world is a globe, he said, and maps are flat. Therefore, all maps are projections of a sphere onto a flat surface. One projection is the universal transverse Mercator grid, which divides the globe into 6-degree grids. It was originally a military projection, but some pilot charts use it.
Evans said, So these numbers are latitude and longitude in a different form.
Correct, a military form.
Kenner ran his finger down the page.
It appears to be several alternate sets of 4 locations. But in every instance, the first and last locations are the same. For whatever reason.
He frowned and stared off into space.
Is that bad?
Sarah said.
I'm not sure, Kenner said. But it might be, yes.
He looked at Sanyong. Sanyong nodded gravely.
What is today?
He said.
Tuesday.
Then, time is very short.
Kenner said.
Sarah, we're going to need George's plane. How many pilots does he have?
2, usually.
We'll need at least 4. How soon can you get them?
I don't know. Where do you want to go? She said.
Chile.
Chile? And leave when?
As soon as possible. No later than midnight.
It'll take me some time to arrange.
Then get started now, Kenner said. Time is short, Sarah. Very short.
Evans watched Sarah go out of the room. He turned back to Kenner.
Okay, he said. I give up. What's in Chile?
A suitable airfield, I presume. With adequate jet fuel.
Kenner snapped his fingers.
Good point, Peter. Sarah!
He called into the next room. What kind of a plane is it?
G-5,
she called back. Kenner turned to Sanyong Tapa, who had taken out a small handheld computer and was tapping away at it. Are you connected to Akamai?
Yes.
Was I right?
I've only checked the first location so far, Sanyong said. But yes, we need to go to Chile.
Then terror is terror, Kenner said.
I think so, yes.
Evans looked from one man to the other. Terror is terror? He said, puzzled. That's right, Kenner said.
Sanyong said, you know, Peter's got a point.
Evans said, are you guys ever going to tell me what's going on? Yes, Kenner said. But first, you have your passport.
I always carry it.
Good man. Kenner turned back to Sanyong. What point?
It's UTM, Professor. It's a 6-degree grid.
Of course, Kenner said, snapping his fingers again. What's the matter with me?
I give up, Evans said. What's the matter with you?
But Kenner didn't answer.
Now he seemed almost hyperactive, his fingers twitching nervously as he picked up the remote control from the table beside Peter and peered at it closely, turning it in the light. Finally, he spoke.
A 6-degree grid, Kenner said. That means these locations are only accurate to 1,000 meters, roughly half a mile. That's simply not good enough.
Why? How accurate should it be?
3 meters, Sanyong said. About 10 feet. Assuming they are using PPS, Kenner said, still squinting at the remote control. In which case... I thought so. It's the oldest trick in the book. He pulled the entire back of the remote off, exposing the circuit board. He lifted that away to reveal a second folded sheet of paper. It was thin, hardly more than tissue paper. It contained rows of numbers and symbols.
All right, Kenner said. This is more like it.
And these are?
Evans said.
True coordinates. Presumably for the same locations.
Terror is terror, Evans said.
He was starting to feel foolish.
Kenner said, yes. We're talking about Mount Terror, Peter. An inactive volcano. You have heard of it.
No.
Well, we're going there.
Where is it?
I thought you'd have guessed that by now, Kenner said. It's in Antarctica, Peter.
Part 2. Terror. To Punta Arenas, Tuesday, October 5th, 9:44 p.m. Van Nuys Airport sank beneath them. The jet turned south, crossing the flat, glowing expanse of the Los Angeles Basin. The flight attendant brought Evans coffee. On the little screen, it said 6,204 miles to destination. Flying time was nearly 12 hours. The flight attendant asked them if they wanted dinner and went off to prepare it.
All right, Evans said. 3 hours ago, I'm coming to help Sarah deal with a robbery. Now I'm flying to Antarctica.
Isn't it time somebody told me what this is about?
Kenner nodded.
Have you heard of the Environmental Liberation Front, ELF?
No, Evans said, shaking his head.
Not me, Sarah said.
It's an underground extremist group, supposedly made up of ex-Greenpeace and Earth First types who thought those organizations had gone soft. ELF engages in violence on behalf of environmental causes. They burned hotels in Colorado, houses on Long Island, spiked trees in Michigan, torched cars in California.
Evans nodded. I read about them. The FBI and other law enforcement agencies can't infiltrate them because the organizations consist of separate cells that never communicate with one another.
Yes, Kenner said, supposedly. But cell phone conversations have been recorded. We've known for some time that the group was going global, planning a series of major events around the world, starting a few days from now.
What kind of events?
Kenner shook his head. That we don't know. But we have reason to think they'll be big.
and destructive.
Sarah said, What does this have to do with George Morton?
Funding, Kenner said. If ELF is preparing actions around the world, they need a lot of money. The question is, where are they getting it?
Are you saying George has funded an extremist group?
Not intentionally. ELF is a criminal organization, but even so, radical groups like PETA fund them. Frankly, it's a disgrace. But the question became whether better-known environmental groups were funding them, too.
Better-known groups like who?
Any of them, Kenner said.
Wait a minute, Sarah said. Are you suggesting that the Audubon Society and the Sierra Club fund terrorist groups?
No, Kenner said. But I'm telling you that nobody knows exactly what any of these groups do with their money because government oversight of foundations and charities is extraordinarily lax. They don't get audited. The books don't get inspected. Environmental groups in the U.S. generate $500 million a year. What they do with it is unsupervised.
Evans frowned. And George knew this?
When I met him, Kenner said, he was already worrying about NERF, what it was doing with its money. It dispenses $44 million a year.
Evans said, You're not going to tell me that NERF...
Not directly, Kenner said. But NERF spends nearly 60% of its money on fundraising. It can't admit that, of course. It'd look bad. It gets around the numbers by contracting nearly all of its work to outside direct mail advertisers and telephone solicitation groups. These groups have misleading names, like the International Wildlife Preservation Fund. That's an Omaha-based direct mail organization that in turn outsources the work to Costa Rica.
You're kidding, Evans said.
No, I am not. And last year, the IWPF spent $650,000 to gather information on environmental issues, including $300,000 to something called the Rainforest Action and Support Coalition, RASC, which turns out to be a Dropbox in Elmira, New York, and an equal sum to Seismic Services in Calgary, another Dropbox.
You mean
a Dropbox, a dead end. That was the true basis of the disagreement between Morton and Drake. Morton felt that Drake wasn't minding the store. That's why he wanted an external audit of the organization. And when Drake refused, Morton got really worried. Morton is on the NERF board. He has liability. So he hired a team of private investigators to investigate NERF.
He did?
Evans said. Kenner nodded. 2 weeks ago.
Evans turned to Sarah. Did you know this? She looked away, then back. He told me I couldn't tell anyone.
George did? I did, Kenner said.
So you were behind this?
No, I merely consulted with George. It was his ball game. But the point is, once you outsource the money, you no longer control how it is spent. Or you have deniability about how it is spent.
Jesus, Evans said. All this time, I just thought George was worried about the Vanuatu lawsuit.
No, Kenner said. The lawsuit is probably hopeless. It is very unlikely it will ever go to trial.
But Balder said when he gets good sea level data.
Balder already has the good data. He has had it for months.
What?
The data show no rise in South Pacific sea levels for the last 30 years.
What?
Kenner turned to Sarah. Is he always like this?
The flight attendant set out placemats, napkins, and silverware. I've got fusilli pasta with chicken, asparagus, and sun-dried tomatoes, she said, and a mixed green salad to follow. Would anyone like wine? White wine, Evan said. I have Pellini Montrachet. I'm not sure of the year. I think it's 98. Mr. Morton usually kept 98 on board.
Just give me the whole bottle, Evan said, trying to make a joke.
Kenner had unnerved him. Earlier in the evening, Kenner had been excited, almost twitchy nervous. But now, sitting on the airplane, he was very still. implacable. He had the manner of a man who was telling obvious truths, even though none of it was obvious to Peter.
I had it all wrong,
Evan said finally. If what you're saying is true. Kenner just nodded slowly. Evans thought,
he's letting me put it together.
He turned to Sarah. Did you know this too?
No, she said, but I knew something was wrong. George was very upset for the last 2 weeks.
You think that's why he gave that speech and then killed himself?
He wanted to embarrass Nerf, Kenner said. He wanted intense media scrutiny of that organization because he wanted to stop what is about to happen.
The wine came and cut glass crystal. Evans gulped it, held out his glass for more. And what is about to happen? He said.
According to the list, there will be 4 events, Kenner said, in 4 locations in the world, roughly 1 day apart.
What kind of events? Kenner shook his head.
We now have 3 good clues.
Sanyong fingered his napkin.
This is real linen, he said, in an awestruck tone, and real crystal.
Nice, huh? Evan said, draining his glass again. Sarah said,
what are the clues?
The first is the fact that the timing is not exact. You might think a terrorist event would be precisely planned, down to the minute. These events are not.
Maybe the group isn't all that well organized.
I doubt that's the explanation. The second clue we got tonight, and it's very important, Kenner said. As you saw from the list, there are several alternate locations for these events. Again, you'd think a terrorist organization would pick one location and stick to it. But this group hasn't done that.
Why not?
I assume it reflects the kind of events that are planned. There must be some uncertainty inherent in the event itself, or the conditions needed for it to take place.
Pretty vague.
It's more than we knew 12 hours ago.
And the third clue? Evan said, gesturing to the flight attendant to refill his glass.
The third clue we've had for some time. Certain government agencies track the sale of restricted high technologies that might be useful to terrorists. For example, they track everything that can be used in nuclear weapons production, centrifuges, certain metals, and so on. They track the sale of all conventional high explosives. They track certain critical biotechnologies. And they track equipment that might be used to disrupt communications networks, that generate electromagnetic impulses, for example, or high-intensity radio frequencies.
Yes?
They do this work with neural network pattern recognition computers that search for regularities in great masses of data. In this case, basically thousands of sales invoices. About 8 months ago, the computers detected a very faint pattern that seemed to indicate a common origin for the widely scattered sale of certain field and electronic equipment.
How did the computer decide that?
The computer doesn't tell you that. It just reports the pattern, which is then investigated by agents on the ground.
And?
The pattern was confirmed. ELF is buying very sophisticated high technology from companies in Vancouver, London, Osaka, Helsinki, and Seoul.
What kind of equipment? Evans said. Kenner ticked them off on his fingers.
Fermentation tanks for AOB primers. That's ammonia-oxidizing bacteria. Mid-level particle dispersal units, military grade. Tectonic impulse generators. Transportable MHD units. Hypersonic cavitation generators. Resonant impact processor assemblies.
I don't know what any of that is, Evans said.
Few people do, Kenner said. Some of it's fairly standard environmental technology, like the AOB primer tanks. They're used in industrial wastewater treatment. Some of it's military, but sold on the open market. And some of it's highly experimental. But it's all expensive.
Sarah said, but how is it going to be used? Kenner shook his head.
Nobody knows. That's what we're going to find out.
How do you think it's going to be used?
I hate to speculate,
Kenner said. He picked up a basket of rolls.
Bread, anyone?
To Punta Arenas, Wednesday, October 6th, 3:01 a.m. The jet flew through the night. The front of the cabin was darkened. Sarah and Sanyang were sleeping on makeshift beds, but Evans couldn't sleep. He sat in the back, staring out the window at the carpet of clouds glowing silver in the moonlight. Kenner sat opposite him.
"It's a beautiful world, isn't it?" he said. "Water vapor is one of the distinctive features of our planet. Makes such beauty. It's surprising there is so little scientific understanding of how water vapor behaves."
"Really?"
"The atmosphere is a bigger mystery than anyone will admit. Simple example. No one can say for sure if global warming will result in more clouds or fewer clouds."
"Wait a minute," Evans said. "Global warming is going to raise the temperature, so more moisture will evaporate from the ocean, and more moisture means more clouds."
"That's one idea. But the higher temperature also means more water vapor in the air, and therefore fewer clouds."
"So which is it?"
"Nobody knows."
"Then how do they make computer models of climate?" Evans said. Kenner smiled.
"As far as cloud cover is concerned, they guess."
"They guess?"
"Well, they don't call it a guess. They call it an estimate, or a parameterization, or an approximation. But if you don't understand something, you can't approximate it. You're really just guessing."
Evans felt the beginnings of a headache. He said, "I think it's time for me to get some sleep."
"Good idea," Kenner said, glancing at his watch. "We still have another 8 hours before we land."
The flight attendant gave Evans some pajamas. He went into the bathroom to change. When he came out, Kenner was still sitting there, staring out the window at the moonlit clouds. Against his better judgment, Evans said, "By the way, you said earlier that the Vanuatu lawsuit won't go to trial."
"That's right."
"Why not? Because of the sea level data?"
"In part, yes. It's hard to claim global warming is flooding your country if sea levels aren't rising."
"It's hard to believe sea levels aren't rising," Evans said. "Everything you read says that they are. All the television reports,"
Kenner said. "Remember African killer bees? There was talk of them for years. They're here now, and apparently there's no problem. Remember Y2K? Everything you read back then said disaster was imminent, went on for months. But in the end, it just wasn't true."
Evans thought that Y2K didn't prove anything about sea levels. He felt an urge to argue that point, but found himself suppressing a yawn.
"It's late," Kenner said. "We can talk all about this in the morning."
"You're not going to sleep?"
"Not yet. I have work to do."
Evans went forward to where the others were sleeping. He lay down across the aisle from Sarah and pulled the covers up to his chin. Now his feet were exposed. He sat up, wrapped the blanket around his toes, and then lay down again. The blanket only came to mid-shoulder. He thought about getting up and asking the flight attendant for another, and then he slept. He awoke to harsh, glaring sunlight. He heard the clink of silverware and smelled coffee. Evans rubbed his eyes and sat up. In the back of the plane, the others were eating breakfast. He looked at his watch. He'd slept for more than 6 hours. He walked to the back of the plane.
"Better eat," Sarah said. "We land in an hour."
They stepped out onto the runway of Marcel Del Mar, shivering in the chill wind that whipped in off the ocean. The land around them was low, green, marshy, and cold. In the distance, Evan saw the jagged snow-covered spires of the El Fagara Range of southern Chile.
"I thought this was summer," he said.
"It is," Kenner said. "Late spring, anyway."
The airfield consisted of a small wooden terminal and a row of corrugated steel hangars, like oversized Quonset huts.
There were 7 or 8 other aircraft on the field, all 4-engine prop planes. Some had skis that were retracted above the landing wheels.
Right on time, Kenner said, pointing to the hills beyond the airport.
A Land Rover was bouncing toward them.
Let's go.
Inside the little terminal, which was little more than a single large room, its walls covered with faded stained air charts, the group tried on parkas, boots, and other gear brought by the Land Rover. The parkas were all bright red or orange.
I tried to get everybody's size right, Kenner said. Make sure you take long johns and microfleece, too.
Evans glanced at Sarah. She was sitting on the floor, pulling on heavy socks and boots. Then she unselfconsciously stripped down to her bra and pulled a fleece top over her head. Her movements were quick, businesslike. She didn't look at any of the men. Sanyong was staring at the charts on the wall and seemed particularly interested in one. Evans went over. What is it?
It's the record from the weather station at Punta Arenas near here. It's the closest city to Antarctica in the world.
He tapped the chart and laughed. There's your global warming. Evans frowned at the chart.
Finish up, everybody, Kenner said, glancing at his watch. Our plane leaves in 10 minutes.
Evans said, Where exactly are we going?
To the base nearest Mount Terror. It's called Waddell Station, run by New Zealanders.
What's there? Not much, mate, the Land Rover driver said, and he laughed.
But the way the weather's been lately, you'll be lucky if you can get there at all.
To Waddell Station, Wednesday, October 6th, 8:04 a.m. Evans stared out of the narrow window of the Hercules. The vibration of the props made him feel sleepy, but he was fascinated by what he saw beneath him. Mile after mile of gray ice, a vista broken by intermittent fog and the occasional outcrop of black rock. It was a monochromatic, sunless world, and it was huge.
Enormous, Kenner said. People have no perspective on Antarctica, because it appears as a fringe at the bottom of most maps. But in fact, Antarctica is a major feature on the Earth's surface and a major factor in our climate. It's a big continent, 1.5 times the size of either Europe or the United States, and it holds 90% of all the ice on the planet.
90%? Sarah said. You mean there's only 10% in the rest of the world?
Actually, since Greenland has 4%, all the other glaciers in the world, Kilimanjaro, the Alps, the Himalayas, Sweden, Norway, Canada, Siberia, they all account for 6% of the planet's ice. The overwhelming majority of the frozen water of our planet is in the continent of Antarctica. In many places, the ice is 5 or 6 miles thick.
No wonder they're concerned that the ice here is melting, Evans said. Kenner said nothing. Sanyong was shaking his head. Evans said, Come on, guys. Antarctica is melting.
Actually, it's not, Sanyong said. I can give you the references if you like.
Kenner said, While you were asleep, Sanyong and I were talking about how to clarify things for you, since you seem to be so ill-informed.
Ill-informed? Evans said, stiffening.
I don't know what else one would call it, Kenner said. Your heart may be in the right place, Peter, but you simply don't know what you're talking about.
Hey, he said, controlling his anger. Antarctica is melting.
You think repetition makes something true? The data show that one relatively small area called the Antarctic Peninsula is melting and calving huge icebergs. That's what gets reported year after year. But the continent as a whole is getting colder, and the ice is getting thicker.
Antarctica is getting colder? Sanyong had taken out a laptop and was hooking it up to a small portable bubble jet printer. He flipped open his laptop screen.
What we decided, Kenner said, is that we're going to give you references from now on, because it's too boring to try and explain everything to you.
A sheet of paper began to buzz out of the printer. Sanyong passed it to Evans.
Okay, well, I see slight cooling referred to here, Evans said. I also see warming of the peninsula of several degrees. That certainly seems more significant, and that peninsula's a pretty big part of the continent, isn't it?
He tossed the paper aside. Frankly, I'm not impressed, Sanyong said.
The peninsula is 2% of the continent. And frankly, I am surprised that you do not comment on the most significant fact in the data you were given.
Which is?
When you said earlier that the Antarctic is melting, Sanyong said, were you aware that it has been melting for the last 6,000 years?
Not specifically, no.
But generally, you knew that.
No, Evans said. I wasn't aware of that.
You thought that the Antarctic melting was something new?
I thought it was melting faster than previously, Evans said.
Maybe we won't bother anymore, Kenner said.
Sanyong nodded and started to put the computer away.
No, no, Evans said. I'm interested in what you have to say. I'm not closed-minded about this. I'm ready to hear new information.
You just did, Kenner said.
Evans picked up the sheet of paper again and folded it carefully. He slipped it into his pocket. These studies are probably financed by the coal industry, he said.
Probably, Kenner said. I'm sure that explains it. But then everybody's paid by somebody. Who pays your salary?
My law firm.
And who pays them?
The clients. We have several hundred clients.
You do work for all of them?
Me personally, no.
In fact, you do most of your work for environmental clients, Kenner said.
Isn't that true?
Mostly, yes.
Would it be fair to say that the environmental clients pay your salary?
Kenner said.
You could make that argument.
I'm just asking, Peter. Would it be fair to say environmentalists pay your salary?
Yes.
Okay. Then would it be fair to say the opinions you hold are because you work for environmentalists?
Of course not.
You mean you're not a paid flunky for the environmental movement?
No, the fact is
you're not an environmental stooge, a mouthpiece for a great fundraising and media machine, a multi-billion-dollar industry in its own right, with its own private agenda that's not necessarily in the public interest.
God damn it!
Is this pissing you off? Kenner said.
You're damn right it is.
Good, Kenner said. Now you know how legitimate scientists feel when their integrity is impugned by slimy characterizations such as the one you just made. Sanyong and I gave you a careful peer-reviewed interpretation of data made by several groups of scientists from several different countries. And your response was first to ignore it and then to make an ad hominem attack. You didn't answer the data. You didn't provide counter-evidence. You just smeared with innuendo.
Oh, fuck you, Evans said. You think you have an answer for everything, but there's only one problem. Nobody agrees with you. Nobody in the world thinks that Antarctica is getting colder.
These scientists do, Kenner said. They published the data.
Evans threw up his hands. The hell with it, he said. I don't want to talk about this anymore. He walked to the front of the plane and sat down, crossed his arms, and stared out the window. Kenner looked at Sanyong and Sarah.
Anyone feel like coffee?
Sarah had watched Kenner and Evans with a certain amount of uneasiness. Even though she had worked for the past 2 years for Morton, she had never shared her employer's passion for environmental issues. All during that time, Sarah had been in a tempestuous, exciting relationship with a handsome young actor. Their time together consisted of an unending series of passionate evenings, angry confrontations, slammed doors, tearful reconciliations, jealousies, and infidelities. And it had consumed her more than she cared to admit. The truth was that she paid no more attention to Nerf or Morton's other environmental interests than the job required.
at least until the son of a bitch actor appeared in the pages of People magazine with a young actress from his TV show, and Sarah finally decided she had had enough, erased the guy from her cell phone, and threw herself into her work. But she certainly held the same general view about the state of the world as Evans did. Perhaps Evans was more aggressive in his stating his views and more trusting of his assumptions, but she basically agreed with him. And here was Kenner, casting doubt after doubt. It left her wondering whether Kenner was really correct about everything he was saying. And it also made her wonder just how he and Morton had become friends. She asked Kenner, "Did you have these same discussions with George?" "In the last weeks of his life, yes." "And did he argue with you the way Evans is?" "No." Kenner shook his head. "Because by then he knew."
"Knew what?"
They were interrupted by the pilot's voice on the intercom. "Good news," he said. "The weather's broken over Waddell, and we will land in 10 minutes. For those of you who have never made a landing on ice, seat belt should be low and tight, and all your gear safely stowed. And we really mean it." The plane began a slow, curving descent. Sarah looked out the window at a crusty expanse of white snow-covered ice. In the distance, she saw a series of brightly colored buildings, red, blue, green, built on a cliff, overlooking the gray and choppy ocean.
"That's Waddell Station," Kenner said.
Waddell Station, Wednesday, October 6th, 11:04 a.m. Trudging toward structures that looked like oversized children's building blocks, Evans kicked a clump of ice out of his path. He was in a grumpy mood. He felt relentlessly bullied by Kenner, whom he now recognized as one of those perpetual contrarians who argued almost all conventional wisdom simply because it was conventional. But since Evans was stuck with this lunatic, at least for the next few days, he decided to avoid Kenner as much as possible, and certainly not engage him in any more conversations. There was no point in arguing with extremists. He looked at Sarah, walking across the ice airfield beside him. Her cheeks were flushed in the cold air. She looked very beautiful. "I think the guy is a nut," Evans said.
"Kenner?"
"Yeah. What do you think?"
She shrugged.
"Maybe." "I bet those references he gave me are fake," he said.
"They'll be easy enough to check," she said.
They stamped their feet and entered the first building. Waddell Research Station turned out to be home to 30-odd scientists, graduate students, technicians, and support staff. Evans was pleasantly surprised to find it was quite comfortable inside, with a cheerful cafeteria, a game room, and a large gym with a row of treadmills. There were big picture windows with views of the choppy, restless ocean. Other windows looked out over the vast, white expanse of the Ross Ice Shelf, stretching away to the west. The head of the station greeted them warmly. He was a heavy-set, bearded scientist named McGregor, who looked like Santa Claus in a Patagonia vest. Evans was annoyed that McGregor seemed to know Kenner, at least by reputation. The two men immediately struck up a friendly conversation. Evans excused himself, saying he wanted to check his email. He was shown to a room with several computer terminals. He signed on to one and went directly to the site for Science Magazine. It took him only a few minutes to determine that the references San Yong had given him were genuine. Evans read the online abstracts and then the full text. He began to feel a little better. Kenner had summarized the raw data correctly, but he had drawn a different interpretation from that of the authors. The authors of these papers were firmly committed to the idea of global warming and said so in the text. Or at least, most of them did. It was a bit complicated. In one paper, it was clear that even though the authors gave lip service to the threat of global warming, their data seemed to suggest the opposite of what they were saying in the text. But that apparent confusion, Evans suspected,
was probably just the result of drawing up a paper with half a dozen authors. What they said was they supported the idea of global warming. And that was what counted. Most disturbing was the paper on the increase in ice thickness in the Ross Ice Shelf. Here Evans found some troubling points. First, the author did say that the shelf had been melting for the last 6,000 years, ever since the Holocene era. Though Evans could not remember reading in any article about melting Antarctic ice that it had been going on for the last 6,000 years. If that were true, it wasn't exactly news. On the contrary, the author suggested that the real news was the end of this long-term melting trend and the first evidence of ice thickening. The author was hinting that this might be the first sign of the start of the next ice age.
Jesus! The next ice age?
There was a knock on the door behind him. Sarah stuck her head in.
Kenner wants us, she said. He's discovered something. Looks like we're going out on the ice.
The map covered the entire wall, showing the enormous star-shaped continent. In the lower right-hand corner was Waddell Station and the curving arc of the Ross Ice Shelf.
We've learned, Kenner said, that a supply ship docked 5 days ago bringing boxes of field material for an American scientist named James Brewster from the University of Michigan. Brewster is a very recent arrival who was permitted to come at the last minute because the terms of his research grant were unusually generous in their allowance for overhead, meaning the station would get some much-needed money for operations.
So he bought his way in, Evans said.
In effect.
When did he get here?
Last week.
Where is he now?
Out in the field. Kenner pointed to the map. Somewhere south of the slopes of Mount Terror, and that's where we're going.
You say this guy's a scientist from Michigan? Sarah said.
No, Kenner said. We just checked with the university. They have a Professor James Brewster, all right. He's a geophysicist at the University of Michigan, and right now he's in Ann Arbor waiting for his wife to deliver a baby.
So who is this guy?
Nobody knows.
And what was his offloaded equipment? Evans said.
Nobody knows that either. It was helicoptered out to the field, still in the original crates. The guy's been out there a week with two so-called graduate students. Whatever he's doing, he's apparently working across a large area, so he moves his base camp frequently. Nobody here knows precisely where he is.
Kenner lowered his voice.
One of the graduate students came back yesterday to do some computer work. But we won't use him to lead us out there for obvious reasons. We'll use one of the staff people at Waddell, Jimmy Bolden. He's very knowledgeable. The weather's too dicey for helicopters, so we'll have to take snow tracks. It's 17 miles to the camp. The snow tracks should get us there in 2 hours. The outside temperature's perfect for springtime in Antarctica. Minus 25 degrees Fahrenheit, so bundle up. Any questions?
Evans glanced at his watch. Won't it get dark soon?
We have much less nighttime now that spring is here. We'll have daylight all the time we're out there. The only problem we face is right here, Kenner said, pointing to the map. We have to cross the shear zone.
End of CD 5.